I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy.
And we are the Rants Macabre. And we're joined today by
Jackson
and
Pete.
And today's subject is horror video games. Since the earliest video games, we in our cultural subset have been fascinated with moving a joystick or entering a command and enacting change on a screen. Sometimes it's been part of a story, or other times we were just a 10-pixel spaceship shooting aliens. Gaming has grown to offer the next level of immersion that books, movies, or television can't compete with. I think films hit a unique and magical point when they joined live action with sound and score. Beyond any naturalistic representation of life, we now had a soundtrack enhancing our perspective, and that was the brilliant standard for over 50 years. Under that standard, though, we are watching all these things happen to an actor who happened to be the best-looking person with passable acting skills who got an audition. In a game, it's happening to you. We're going from being the witness to stories on screen to being the protagonist ourselves. For horror fans, those of us who like to be scared, who invite it, there's never been a better platform. If horror movies can be described as a scary roller coaster, then horror video games have taken the coaster off the tracks and given you the steering wheel. Beyond active cinematography, custom sound design, and original music scores, we are now engaging in storytelling with active decision-making and consequences. And as games mature and Moore's Law keeps predicting the racing evolution of technology, video games are fast becoming a wholly immersive experience. So on today's episode, we're going to cover some of the greatest horror video games, from old to new, with a couple of lifelong gamers. So Jackson, I'll ask you first. You're a musician and lifelong gamer. Do you remember what game it was that hooked you, that sort of broadened your imagination of what video games might be?
I would say specifically Final Fantasy III, parentheses 6, and Chrono Trigger are the two that really spoke to me on a larger level, more than, you know, blue block hits red block for XP 1. You know, that was really where the storytelling of the actual video game became more so than just a series of pixels moving around in a competitive fashion.
And that was... It was the stories that drew you in?
Yeah, what? Absolutely. Yeah. It's because those games are, you know, those are all turn-based structures. So it's not something where it has the instant gratification of, say, like a first-person shooter. A lot of people find them to be a bit like slow-paced as a result of that. But what to me really speaks of those games was the immersive storyline. It's like reading a book, but the book also has an amazing soundtrack, and it also has an amazing interactive element about it.
Cool. And Pete, what was the game that did it for you?
It's actually a few, real brief, like for instance, the first Metroid introduced one of my favorite game mechanics in the entire world, which is you'll see an item just out of reach. And you'll keep trying to jump, and you'll keep trying to jump, and you just can't get it. And after a while, you start going, am I supposed to be able to get that? Can I not get that? And what it does is immediately you start going, wait, I have to try and find a way around this to get back there. And that little tiny game mechanic birthed this huge idea of adventure and exploration and opened up a whole new way we play games. And I guess more recently would be the Mass Effect series. Kind of what you were talking about, Jackson was talking about before, was just this trilogy story, this gigantic story where every choice that you make actually has a huge payoff and consequence later on. Really, really impressive game.
Melinda, what was it for you?
For me, it would be the Legend of Zelda series. Absolutely. My most favorite game is the SNES Link to the Past, because to me, it's like reading a Tolkien series is like going on an epic, epic journey. And when I sit down still, I'll sit down and play that game. And just like, even though you know what's going to happen, you know the entire story, it's still so much fun to play. My family, my mom, like I grew up, my mom was always playing Zelda on the NES. And then my grandfather, who just recently passed away, was a lifelong, I mean, as soon as games started, like he would play, and he would play these games with himself where he would try and not get any extra things. So he would try and beat the game with the least amount of hearts he could get. And he loved Nintendo and Nintendo games. So he would beat the game and that would be fine. And then he would like play it again with his few, like, I'm going to get as little weapons as possible, or I'm going to try and shoot the least amount of times possible. Yeah. And he would keep track of every single thing. Very meticulous.
Did you guys, so we've talked about consoles, but it was a conversation Pete and I had that, like, the earliest gaming being PC-centric, PCs were ahead of the curve in terms of what consoles could do.
They always have been, always will be.
Did you guys have experience with PC games?
I did. I played, when I was really, really little, we had an Apple II GS, and I played the Dungeons & Dragons Pool of Radiance game, which was mostly, like, you know, up, grass and stuff like that. But every now and then a monster would jump out and you'd cast a spell, which is strange for me because I'm not into RPG. It's not because I am into instant gratification. But as a little kid, I loved that game and I would play it all the time.
Absolutely. I'm actually racking my brain right now to think about how, like, non-Minesweep / solitaire games. But, like, for instance, the first Diablo was a very important game for me. But, yeah, I definitely did a lot of PC gaming, but I've been more of a console person.
Yeah, we talked about Wolfenstein earlier, and that was exclusively PC for years, right?
Yes.
The first Wolfenstein? And I guess that was followed up by Doom, which kind of upped the stakes dramatically in terms of graphics and playability.
One of the big, I'm sure you can speak to this probably better than I can, as being a person who's a little bit more of a console person, one of the really great parts about PC gaming is, in addition to being kind of cutting edge from as far as what the actual machine can do, you also get a lot more buttons. You get, you know, the mouse with keyboard combination has a lot more options and a lot more flexibility, whereas in when you're, you know, A, B, select, start, and D-pad is not necessarily going to give you, I have 17 spells that I can cast immediately. That's just not an option. I mean, they're getting there, and some of the games are they have a little bit more of a, like, hold down LT and press X and then rub your belly and stand on one foot. So they're getting better about it, but you're never going to have the amount of characters on a standard keyboard accessible on on an actual console controller.
Yeah, it seems like even cross-platform games, it's pretty common that people prefer the PC version. They like the mouse and keyboard combo.
That's always going to be the case. The mouse and keyboard is always, especially for first-person shooters, you have much more precision on a PC. People like PCs also because the graphics are always more up to date. It's cutting edge.
Well, I was going to ask you, so on our list is The Seventh Guest, and that was a groundbreaker in terms of challenging hardware. All of a sudden, this was a game that you might have to upgrade your computer to use. I had never heard of it, but could you speak to Seventh Guest?
I was a huge PC gamer in the beginning. I had a PC way before a lot of the people on my block did, and I loved all the games that you guys may never even heard of, like Leadership Larry, all the LucasArts games, Maniac Mansion we were even talking
Absolutely.
About before. So The Seventh Guest was this new game that came out, I think, in 1993.
Yes,
actually.
From 93.
And it was this game that you were in this haunted mansion, and because you were in this haunted mansion, and there was a beautiful 3D graphics where you could explore this mansion, it required some heavy-duty processing, and that came in the way of a CD-ROM. Now, most computers barely had a CD-ROM, and if they did, it was very, very low speed. And when everyone saw this game, and Bill Gates was one of the people that stood behind this game saying, this is the future. And when everyone heard that and saw it and they saw the magazines, everyone ran out and bought hardware to adapt to that game. So it was one of the first times almost ever where the game sold the hardware.
Yeah, I had played that one. But it was one that really irritated. It gave me agita because if you didn't do things soon enough, the bad guy or the old man Henry would taunt you and yell at you, and he'd be like, "Well, if you keep going at that speed," and you're just like, "Calm down, I'm scared." You know, it was really like.
Could you guys talk about what the game is actually about? I have
sure.
no idea.
Do you remember it?
No, I remember the guy made toys that killed kids.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Some of the hammiest acting. It's the greatest acting of all time. So there's this old, it was a drifter, if you remember the actual opening. There was a drifter, he comes across, he goes to this town, and he goes, "Hey, maybe if I make these toys, I can become famous." I'm kind of abbreviating here. He sells these toys, and what happens is he's selling his toys to little girls, and the girls are mysteriously dying.
Right.
So somehow his business continues to grow, though, and he becomes rich.
Because it's like something about like a toy for life.
A stuffed toy for life.
Right. Right.
And so the idea is that he becomes wealthy and he has this big mansion. He throws a party for 7 guests, and you are introduced to 6 of them. But where's the 7th guest? And that's kind of the mystery of the game. And what happens is you in order to solve the puzzle of what's going on, what's the story, you know, what's this game about? You solve these puzzles because he was a toy maker. So, for instance, I think the first puzzle is you'll go to a dining room and there's a cake.
Yeah, the cake.
And you have to cut the cake into X amount of pieces. And then once you solve that puzzle, you see a little movie come up and you see a little piece of the equation, you know.
But if you fail or you take too long, then he yells at you.
Yes, he'll always yell at you.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really, it gives you really bad anxiety. Yeah. I'm not good under pressure.
That's pretty ballsy for a game in 1993 where, like, just incidentally, children are dying.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, back then, you know, those games weren't really as censored. And so you had some pretty big topics going on there, some rough stuff going on back there. You know, like even there's another game that we may get to later had to do with rape and the Holocaust. And, I mean, so stuff back then wasn't as regulated.
What game was that?
I Have No Mouth. It deals with rape. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I heard a Leisure Suit Larry sneak in there before. That's pretty. I don't think you couldn't get away with that until they made one for, I believe, PS2.
Magna Cum Laude.
Yeah, that was like the first time that crossed over onto a console.
Well, that was his cousin or something. They tried to update the series.
Leisure Suit Mitch.
It was a game that featured boobs.
Yeah, lots of them. Leisure Suit Larry, where these games had definitely nothing to do with horror, but it was these kind of text adventures where it's a graphic adventure, but you would type, you know, pick up pen, da 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 da, give to.
And it was 8-bit-ish in terms of like,
and it was all about getting laid. Was the entire game was getting laid.
So staying on the subject of adventure and puzzle horror, one that Pete sent me a link for was Bad Mojo. Yeah. And this also seemed sort of early CD-ROM days because there was the opening is rendered video. Again, terrible acting. But the intro is all filmed and then rendered for the video game where you wind up turning into a cockroach. Which is kind of its own horror.
Absolutely. I mean, because one of the things you'll notice that a lot of these early games, horror started to come around these mid-90s, or the early 90s, rather, because the technology finally caught up. Because before, you really had a hard time scaring someone with 8-bit graphics. Sure. There really wasn't much there. But if you could get actors, and if you could get CD-ROM quality music and a score, and you could, you know, get kind of some effects like that, you had a chance at it. Unfortunately, it was the really bad acting that really kind of stood out in a lot of these. But that's why you'll see that in those early 90s, you start to see a lot more horror games, a lot, you know, that I'm sure we'll cover. And one of those is Bad Mojo.
I guess one of the things you touched on was the idea that these were like a subgenre. So you could get away with a lot in the same way that like Stephen King can write about just about anything. And, you know, that might have been in the early 80s. Video games were such a niche thing that no one's really looking at, like, what your content is. And I guess just the same, I guess kid gaming probably, were they writing video games for kids, or it was meant to be for adults?
These
early 90s.
It was kind of meant for them. They had a very small warning that would just say, you know, not for, there's some nudity or not
there's
for kids.
There's rape and Holocaust.
Yeah.
And I Have No Mouth.
It wasn't really until a game called Night Trap, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with, who starred from Different Strokes. The
Gary Coleman?
No, not Gary Coleman, the sister.
What you talking about?
The sister.
Dana Plato.
Dana Plato, she was in that.
Was it a porn game?
Semi, it's a horror set. Yeah, it's sort of that. We're on a break, I'll show you it. So anyway, until Night Trap.
A content warning.
The content warning and a game called Phantasmagoria, another horror game where there was nudity. Oh, yeah. Nudity was primarily the factor. And where the real ratings came in later, that's when you start talking about like Grand Theft Auto and stuff, where people started to lose their minds about it. But back in the day, it was exactly as you said, it was books. It was a whole bunch of games that not parents didn't really know about, kids didn't really know about, and sometimes you're pulling a game that had sexual content or violence, etc.
Well, you wanted to talk about Maniac Mansion, and that's... Okay, that was Maniac Mansion a console game, or was it...
Originally for Commodore. Maniac Mansion.
That was like the Amiga or something, right?
It was on Commodore 64, I know, yeah. And it was a stand-up game, like an arcade stand-up game, I heard that it was. Camping. I mean, you would be standing there for hours, I guess.
For hours and hours.
I don't know if it was a mini game, but it Commodore hurts. 64, it was also on the Apple II.
Apple II. It should have been a lot of things. Yeah.
I played it on NES. That's where and I got it from like a garage sale. My parents didn't know what it was, kind of a thing, and because that's the only way that we got new video games in my house was from garage sales. So it's from 87, but I probably played it like 1990 and thought I was like hot shit. But I didn't know anything about it, and it's one of my favorite games still to this day to play because there's so much in it. Have you ever played it, Darren?
I haven't. I'm a little bit surprised because Nintendo was kind of... They were squeamish when it came to like Mortal Kombat and Blood and Guts, so I'm a little surprised at Maniac Mansion. How gritty does it get?
Well, no, it's like fun Blood and Guts. I mean, you know, there's like talking plants. It's very sci-fi, less like horror, but there's a little bit of implied gore for sure in there. You get kidnapped for whatever reason. Some of the girls will get kidnapped, and it's kind of implied like this is a bad thing to be kidnapped by this guy, you know. You get put down in your prison for a while. You start out with your characters and you choose your cast, and it's very like choose your own adventure kind of a story, and you can play for hours and hours.
It sounds like the hotel that H.H. Holmes ran.
Yeah. Oh, definitely, because there's secret ways to get out of the basement as well, yeah, if you want to. So, did you play Maniac Mansion when you were little?
Really, when we got an additional copy of it for NES, and it's really interesting to get into it because it feels very much so like a game that should have a mouse and a keyboard.
Definitely.
Whereas
PC in feel.
With just, you know, with the Nintendo controller, moving your cursor over a thing that says talk and then, I didn't mean to do that. I meant jump. and everything is very, it's a side scroller with an additional plane that you can sort of move up and down. So it's not really 3D. So the whole thing feels very much so like it would live on a PC a lot easier.
That idea of exploration, like, you know, we sort of talked about games with consequences and that sort of dynamic where you're making decisions and, you know, everything's followed by some design of the game. But the exploration idea is an interesting one because it kind of happened. If Maniac Mansion was 1987, there is, you know, somewhere there was a script. There was a multi-tiered script where they're deciding on the physical layout, and every place you wind up has a cause and effect to it.
It's very sandboxy, even though, I mean, you still only have one goal, you know, which is to foil the plans and everything. But there's a lot of side things that you can do in that. For as early as it was, it's very sandbox feeling, I think. You know, there's sub-games as well because there's an arcade system and you can play the arcade games should you, you know, want to do that as well.
Just real quick. Yeah. Maniac Mansion is actually a very, very important game. And like the legacy of gaming, guy named Ron Gilbert created it through George Lucas. I don't know if you guys knew that. It was through LucasArts company. And that LucasArts was a very story-driven, they wanted to make experience the number one priority of all the games, kind of bring a movie kind of feel, a book feel, a narration feel to games. And because of Maniac Mansion, you pretty much have everything that we've discussed prior to this podcast, which was Bad Mojo, Seventh Gate. Everything is from that genre, including Leader Shoot Larry. Every adventure game that ever came forward is from Maniac Mansion. So extremely important. It created the idea of exploration.
I wanted to ask you, in the writing of these games, you've had some experience with companies and you've gotten to see like the kind of scripts that go into these games. And they're more the modern games, but it's kind of representative of, you know, you've got a novel and, you know, it's your stack of pages. And even if the novel is non-linear, you're still going from beginning to end. But writing for a video game, you are writing, you know, so many variations on, you know, again, cause and effect and all these different decision makers. So I thought that the closest you could approximate is a choose your own adventure story. But realistically, any choose your own adventure story should be called choose your own adventure out of these two options. But as video games present, like, okay, now you've got 23 different possibilities out of this, and each one of those is going to follow with another 23. Yeah. Could you speak about the script sort of dynamic?
Sure. I mean, if you, especially even Maniac Mansion, I followed a thing called the Scum Engine, which was what actually they were able to create these adventure games. And these adventure games came from actually dice games, the old Dungeons and Dragons games, where you were writing, you know, if this happens, then this, and you know, you have this level of magic, et cetera. And so what happened was when they first made Maniac Mansion and some text adventures prior to it, which were literally text, you know, go west, go north. They did. They had to write scripts, entire scripts of the first to get the layout of the land. Okay, here's the mansion. And then it was just if this, then this. And they'd make these trees. And you can actually, for Maniac Mansion, you can actually look at some of the old designs where you just see this huge map of all those things. If this, then this. They'd write all the dialogue. And then with Maniac Mansion, you even had different characters.
Yeah, you could choose your own team. And so depending on who you choose, they have different skills.
Okay.
So certain people you need for certain things, or you just can't do that part of the game if you didn't choose that character.
So there was a lot of variables. You had, there was just so much writing.
Yeah, because consequences, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, if we're talking about bad consequences, I think the latest Tomb Raider, the latest Lara Croft, has some
Did
of
this just demo at E3?
No, it was out last year, maybe.
Like when the pole goes through her neck?
It's the most graphic thing. It's not a horror game, but what happens to her is horrific. Horrific.
I would say that is, if not the, certainly in the top three most ingenuitive ways with which to kill a protagonist
and over and over again.
Yeah, like you're speaking about the pole scene. It's everyone that played that game got stuck there for a few minutes, and she just continuously gets a stick through the bottom of her mouth, through her jaw, and out the top of her head. But she squirms for a second.
She tries to claw away.
The problem is it's really fast. She's like falling down a river, so you have to really, really think fast. And you already know, maybe because you probably died the first time, so you know this is like a horrible death waiting her. So you're already really, really like amped up, and you know probably it'll take you probably four times maybe to get through it.
Yeah, it's essentially a Banjo and Kazooie going down river left, right to avoid obstacles is what's really going on. But the
but they never got a piece of wood stuck through their face.
There's no better way of watching it than watching Conan O'Brien play it.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Clueless Gamer. Yeah.
You have to. It's just watch that. It's better than playing it because he has the best reaction in the world to it. He's also thinking how hot she is, and so then they actually tell him to tone it down. But but you have to see that. But the question you're talking about, the consequence. What do you mean by the consequence of?
I was asking.
That's a perfect segue of like permadeath. Like that's a huge.
Okay. When we say permadeath, we mean there's no redo. There's no going back with your character. Is that what you mean by permadeath?
There's a permadeath movement, and then maybe you can talk about like Diablo. There's a permadeath movement right now, especially in the indie scene, which is based. There's a number of ways you can do this. At its root, it's just saying once you're dead, you're dead. Mm-hmm. The end. Okay. And there's different levels of that. So some RPGs, some JRPGs, you have a character that may go along with you on a quest. And if that person dies, that's it. They're not coming back. There's no magic spell you can revive them with. That character's story is now over. And now there are consequences to that because maybe now you've lost a team member. You can't go on with that. And I think you were talking about Diablo too. Yeah,
Diablo is a great example of that where they have hardcore mode, which is essentially, like you're saying, it's just you spend, you know, you dump 20 hours into this character. You get all your end game gear. You're really excited about it. And then some 13-year-old just springs a trap and kills you, and it's just you're done. That's it. And that's
I remember when that happened to you.
I may or may not have stopped playing that game for several years as a result of that.
But I just want to say, like, it's what's, and a lot of people who don't play games, they may go like, well, what's the point of that? Isn't games supposed to be fun? And the reason that permadeath and having hard consequences is kind of an interesting thing is suddenly the experience that you're having is extremely important because you know that if you don't succeed at this, there's a very harsh consequence. And so suddenly, even if it's a little tiny 8-bit game, that has no real threat to you, but the fact that here comes this 8-bit monster, but oh God, if I don't get around him, I'm gonna lose. You're playing to win and you do not want to die. And so suddenly you're very invested in the game. And that's why it's an interesting thing, especially that independent game designers are really playing with now, is to really give you that immersion now.
Yeah, it's a ballsy thing. And I think a lot of people probably think of it as almost contradicting the assumed dynamic of a video game, where like, well, I'll just reset and start again. Now designers are kind of getting a little ballsier and a little more edgy with storytelling. There's no going back.
I'm sorry. There are games now that actually the game destructs. That's it. You will never play that game again.
Right.
Yeah.
What games?
So there's some in development. And again, the idea is that if you don't make it, let's say you're playing a first person shooter and you're going around that corner, if you know you're going to respawn, you're going to come back in the game in 2 seconds,
right.
It's just kind of this shooting match that you could just have a beer and keep playing.
And you take bigger risks, I think.
Absolutely.
Conservatively.
But if you're going around the corner and it's like, oh God, I now have to pay $50 again.
you really are shaking. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that level of immersion is something that nothing else can give you. No book, no movie, other than the real experience of being in some kind of danger.
But one of the, to kind of piggyback what you were talking about, one of the kind of investment equals immersion equation of that is your investment for a lot of gamers becomes time. So when you've put X amount of time into developing whatever, style of game that happens to be, and then that gets completely, that time is then deleted. That seems for a lot of gamers that's like time is the essence, and that is even a financial or any like standings would be less of an issue than, oh shit, really? I got 20 more hours to even start, and then another 20 on top of that, and then you start thinking about it, like, that's 60 hours, and I could have been riding a bike around the block.
Learning to fly a helicopter.
It could be doing a lot of things. Because I remember, I don't know if you know the game, it's not horror, but Adventure Island is one where you can die multiple times, but once your lives are up. Doesn't matter where you are in the game, and you have to start. There's no continuing on. And so that was when, you'd put it on pause and then, like, leave to go to school or do your whatever you were doing. Then you, like, and I played it in college, and I would get to really close to the end the last time that I played it because it's a heartbreaking game. And I put it on pause, went to class. I came home, the power went out. And I lost my save spot. And it is.
We didn't want to tell her for a few hours. It was a thing.
It's like, oh, Mindy, good, you're sitting down. No, put down the controller.
But the risk is real, and you do. You have so much time invested when you're playing these things.
I was thinking about, and I'm sure it's happened to every gamer, the dynamic of saving and certain games where... You rarely come across the same kind of regret in an art form as you do in real life. And I'm talking about specifically, you reach a point in a game where you're dissatisfied with your performance, but you made it so far that you're compelled to save. But at the same time, you're thinking, like, I could have done that better, but I don't want to go back and start again from scratch because son of a bitch. And, like, I'm sure any person with empathy, there's certain memories of shit you've done in the past where you kind of still wince at something you said or something you did. And never in a piece of art or storytelling do you kind of revisit that same feeling. But in video games, you get that shit over and over and over again.
I think, and this is a good segue. I think one of the biggest things was the original Resident Evil. And if you didn't pick up a key card over here one time, yeah, you have lost. And that's that. And there's some real consequences in that original Resident Evil. And then we can talk about the Resident Evil series.
Let's dive in. I see it as a watershed moment where it was cinematic to the point where it wasn't even important that I be playing the game. I was just thrilled to be watching someone else play the game. And we hit points where, like, we had to put down the remote, the controller because it was too much. Resident Evil introduced the horror dynamic to both the puzzle and this, like, again, pushing the hardware to something that hadn't been seen or done before. Could you speak to that?
Yeah. Well, if you go real back, actually it was started from a Japanese movie called Sweet Home, and that was turned into a really bad Nintendo game. And the
Is it called the same thing?
Sweet Home? Sweet Home. And the creator, I want to say Shinji, I don't remember his name. So I'll just call him the creator from here on out. Okay. So the creator of Resident Evil, he wanted to make something that was cinematic. And they came up to some problems, though, because the technology for his ideas just weren't working. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you guys knew this, Resident Evil was originally a first-person almost shooter.
I can see that.
And he, the creator of the game, is going, this is not scary. This doesn't look like a scary mansion. And so what they had to do was create pre-rendered backgrounds. And that's what the majority of the game is. And what pre-rendered backgrounds is just basically they model the, in this case, the mansion, and then they would just make a screenshot of that.
Yeah. And so, they locked down the camera. Resident Evil, it was a while before the camera was following you.
Right. And that, though, that limitation actually made the game feel cinematic because every time you entered a room, the camera was kind of at a high angle looking at you, or at a Dutch tilt or whatever. So they played with that and actually really worked to its advantage. So that's another game that pushed kind of the hardware. Certainly nothing looked like that back then. Everyone looked, oh, I got to get a PlayStation around that.
Right.
Yeah. Did you guys play you must have played Resident Evil on PlayStation.
Yeah, I guess all of them. Yeah. On PlayStation. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just kind of thinking back, I'm pretty sure every single one of them.
I remember seeing that and just going, like, this feels like, wow, games are now going into a whole new realm. Because prior to that, we had just 16-bit games for the most part. Or, you know, you had the Seventh Guest actors, but we had never seen actual game polygon actors, characters, rather, moving around the space, firing at these scary zombies. We'd never seen that. We saw Sonic. We saw Mario.
And it's funny that you watch it now, and it's... You know, it's not laughable, but it's kind of ridiculous compared to what they're doing. But at the time, it was like, it's never going to get more real than this.
Absolutely.
Oh, it was, yeah, it was a really, really scary game.
Most definitely. Yeah, it's, I think the one in the chronologically that really grabbed me was Code Veronica, though. That was, correct me if I'm wrong, it was Dreamcast. Yeah. And that was the one that really, where it got to the point where it was, like you're saying, it was no longer 16-bit. Everything looked, you know, it's not a photograph, but it's moving in that direction from that kind of blocky style of Mario.
Right.
So that was really, I think Code Veronica was the one that really jumped out on the earlier versions of those, obviously going into 4 being my piece de la resistance of the whole whole series.
Yeah, 4, definitely.
And that, I mean, that's one of my favorite games, flat out, no matter what. So
the original Resident Evil struck me as being so good that you didn't even mind the horrible acting involved. And does anybody, I don't know how a Japanese company sources a script and actors, but it seems like if there was one place where they cut costs, that was it.
To me, it made it better. I loved Resident Evil for the terrible, terrible acting.
A dining room. What? What is this?
What is it?
Blood. Jill, see if you can find any other clues. I'll be examining this. Hope this is not Chris's blood.
And do you remember the first original film sequence where they had the puppet dogs biting them and chasing them? Because if you haven't, you really owe it to yourself to see.
Wait, the dogs that come through the front door?
So the original Resident Evil had an actual filmed sequence. It wasn't using polygon characters. This was actual filmed actors where the guy had, like, one of the actors had, like, this super blonde hair that was up. I think it was, like, Wesker or whatever his name was. Anyway, yeah, and they get dropped in front of the mansion, and they see the helicopter leaving. They're like,
"That's right,
damn you for leaving us!"
They run to the
And then you see puppet dogs running after them with little plastic teeth, and they're running out. It's fantastic. You owe it to yourself to watch it, and that made the game, because to me, with the camera angles and everything, it actually made it like a B movie, and it kind of added to the charm. It felt like a B movie, a horror movie.
See, I have no patience sometimes for cutscenes. I just want to go.
You probably did.
And
you probably
just pushed start. The button. Yeah, I will push that button until it's time to go. I don't do cutscenes.
So that you missed the magic.
So Resident Evil, was it 97? When was the first?
Oh, Resident Evil is like 94. 596 in there somewhere.
Okay. So not long after came the Silent Hill series. Mm-hmm. And Pete and I have talked about the sort of origin. And I guess one of the most recognizable dynamics is the, like, mist that grows over the town. And it's kind of a story in terms of designers working with a limitation and then discovering some whole new shit.
Yeah, so what happened was they wanted to... Capcom had Resident Evil. Konami, who was behind Silent Hill, they had a problem on their hands. They wanted to make something, but they wanted to make it even better. And they wanted to make it psychologically scary. So they wanted to give the player the option to explore, not a mansion, but an entire town. But the problem was, at the time, they had a draw distance problem. What a draw distance problem means is, in any 3D game, is, well, let's say you're looking, you know, in front of you, if let's say it's a first-person shooter, and you're looking ahead. Back then, you could only see not even a block away. You were, like, looking maybe, you know, 50 feet away, and that was about it. And if you remember, especially Nintendo 64 games of that time period, you always saw this blur and fogging and distortion.
And then things would jump out into the forefront.
They actually used the draw distance to their advantage. They said, well, if we add fog to everything, then it becomes really creepy and scary, and now we have nothing to process because everything's hidden. So that's how Silent Hill came. It was actually a draw distance limitation.
That's pretty cool. That's cool. I didn't know that, because yeah. I just think, when I think of that game, I think it's one of the scariest games.
And you'll notice there's no pre-rendered backgrounds. Resident Evil had those pre-rendered angles. Mm-hmm. This you could explore, but that's why there's all that fog. And I thought it was great. It was very
so
scary.
Cool. Yeah.
And it was a moving camera, and like you said, it was the first like open architecture. It was the first like sandbox style game of that sort.
It wasn't of any game, but of particularly in horror, it was where it finally allowed you to kind of explore and roam around the world.
Yeah, the monsters in Silent Hill, the fog is definitely like one of the creepiest elements, but they also took like a really unique view to the monsters, and it was actually translated pretty well. The movie's not great, but the monsters in the the Silent Hill movie are...
The monster design is fantastic, yeah.
And the motion, everything involved is otherworldly and unsettling. So those were the early Silent Hill, and now like processing power jump, so they, you know, they're free to do whatever they want. Most recently, we got the really bad news that the newest Silent Hill that was in development with Guillermo del Toro, and I don't remember
Hideo
the fellow.
Kojima.
Yeah, Pete's pretty good with the designer names.
I know, like, Japanese CEOs and stuff. Yeah, it's sad.
So I was saying, so it was put on indefinite hold. It was canceled. And that was heartbreaking because the playable teaser that they put out was some next level shit. Pete, could you talk about that development? You're sort of, I don't know, you were pretty heartbroken when that was canceled.
So Silent Hill was going downhill for a really long time. After 2 was considered like that was the best of them all. 3 was really good, but not as good as 2. And then everything went downhill. They had like Downpour, Origins, Shattered Memory. All these games that you probably never even heard of because they weren't doing that well. So they needed a reboot. And so Kojima, who actually a lot of people know him from the Metal Gear Solid series, that's also a Konami game, was kind of secretly brought in to go, let's reboot this thing. Let's bring your classic, he has a cinematic style of game making. Let's bring that in. Let's also bring an actual cinematic horror master, which is Del Toro. Kind of put them in the same room and make something. And they were making something really impressive. They were trying to make something very photorealistic. The other Silent Hill games are very different than the PT playable teaser that we've seen. Usually those are primarily third-person over-the-shoulder games. This was a first-person game that kind of puts you in that person's perspective. And it was extremely photorealistic, and that was what they wanted to do. They had, like, that was number one on the list. Everything has to look photoreal. And if you've ever played it, then you'll really know how heartbroken you should be, because I, every time I play a game, I have the headphones on, I play it properly by myself in the dark, and every time I would have to take breaks going, this is too much, I don't like this, and I generally don't get scared of anything. This game would do it, because you would be walking down in this permanent loop of this apartment. I guess we should talk about we should probably talk about what the thing is actually, right?
Sure, yeah.
So the game is a very, very basic premise, and I think that's what makes it really scary, is you wake up in this place you don't know where. You open the door and you're in this hallway that you've seen a million times before. It's everyone's hallway in a home. And the idea is, as you keep walking around this hallway, you, once you open a door, you start right back at the beginning. You're in this permanent purgatory loop. And as you're walking around this environment, you're hearing radio stations talk about murders and stuff like that. So you're starting to uncover this mystery of what's going on, what weird events, what scary events are going on in front of you.
And the sound component, it seemed like it played a huge part also in terms of the eerie dynamic, where in 5.1 sound, you're listening to shit sneak up behind you.
You hear people breathing right behind you. It's the most unnerving thing in the entire world. The entire game is terrifying. You're just around a corner, and you'll just see someone's eye just staring at you right in between the slit of a door, and then they'll close the door real quickly. And part of you wants to explore that, and part of you just wants to leave and just go away and turn everything off and never, ever return again. So you guys haven't... Have you guys
We've
not played
it? We've only watched the
videos. Yeah, we haven't actually played it.
What were your guys' impressions of it?
It's just spooky. Just some of the textures and the environment, they really built an awesome world. Yeah, that's something that I try to look for, is what kind of a universe has been made. Like, what kind of what is the sandbox that I'm playing in look like? And that was a really, like you're saying, that photoreal ideal of something that is very it's identifiable. But at the same time, it's supernatural. So the whole thing felt very, very creepy.
One of the things I was reminded by in watching a bunch of playthroughs, it seemed like the next up in terms of what has come before it was the game Outlast. And Pete and I have talked about it. Have you guys seen the game Outlast? It's essentially...
Seen chunks of it.
Sneaking into... an insane asylum for, home for the criminally insane kind of thing. I was most impressed that the gameplay, the cinematography, and the sort of speed ramps that the camera does are very natural in terms of how a panicky person looks around a room. Like, your head's whipping around, and there's always something on games before this that has sort of felt a little lagging in terms of camera movement, but this was very naturalistic. And the setting is pretty terrifying on its own. And also, like, sort of ghosts and monsters appearing on their own time when they feel like it, just, happens to be when it's going to be most scary. Let's see. Pete, do you have anything on Outlast?
Or are you going to close PT?
You're
going to come back to that?
Yeah, well, is there something specific?
Because you should let everyone know that you're not getting it because of Pachinko.
I was... Okay, so that is it. Konami,
Pachinko, and like couches.
Capcom.
That's Konami.
Konami.
They're focusing on mobile and couches and things that they sell in Japan.
Let me. So the company that was going to put all their efforts into this next Silent Hill game, which was going to star Norman Reedus, which is an extra heartbreak for Mindy.
Yeah.
They canceled it, but their priorities are in a really curious place. And Pete mentioned that they're also the biggest manufacturer of like digital gaming and gambling.
Yeah, there's a lot of, believe it or not, a lot of companies. Like, Sega is huge into pachinko in Japan. They like Konami doesn't just make games. I believe they make furniture, just other stuff. I wouldn't be surprised.
But it's scary. It's scary.
So they make other stuff.
It's made out of people.
And what's happening is Konami, it looks like they're leaving the game space. After Metal Gear Solid 5 comes out, which is going to be really soon, which Kojima was working on, who's also behind Silent Hill, it looks like they're closing shop, and they'll make a game here or there. But they're really focusing on mobile, because right now in Japan, Japanese people are leaving their consoles. It's all about the phones. They want to keep that priority over there as mobile and whatever else they make, like beach balls, whatever they make.
It's like a reminiscent heartbreak of all the Sega fans who were wild about that console. And, like, there were Nintendo fans and there were Sega fans. And when they stopped making consoles, and just, you know, thankfully they are still making games. And the Alien,
you're not getting another Sonic on a system because of pachinko. Like, they did, that's why.
Goddamn pachinko.
They love pachinko.
I mean, at a certain point, the hedgehog runs forward and collects rings. You know, how many times can you reinvent the wheel?
one quick thing about the PT thing. One of the best things that that PT offered was a real throwback to very old school gaming. So if you're an old person and you played Zelda and stuff back in the day, there was no internet.
Did you just call me old?
I believe I did. We're all in the same boat.
Oh man.
So, for the record, Pete's the oldest of us.
Yeah. For this old man here, you know, we used to be in the schoolyard and someone would say, like, oh, did you know that if you burn the third tree on the screen 7, you get this? And it was like, wow. And sometimes there'd be, you know, a bastard who would tell you that things are totally false. Like, oh, yeah, if you burn the tree 18 times, spin around in a circle, you get this. And you try that, and that really didn't work. But anyway, in the age of the internet, that's kind of thrown out the window. You don't really, you know, need that anymore, because you can look at a, like, Maniac Mansion, you can look online,
right,
boom, very quickly find out how a walkthrough. But the great thing about PT that a lot of people didn't know is that no one knew what PT was. No one knew it was Silent Hill. No one knew anything. You had to get through the adventure in order to find the secret, which is that Norman Reedus is in it,
yeah,
that Kojima's behind it, that Guillermo del Toro is behind it, and that it was actually a Silent Hill reboot. So if you look, while this was all going on, there was so many great internet lore, so many internet, like, fables going on. Like, oh, if you turn on your microphone... I don't know, did you guys hear this? If you turn on, you put a microphone into the controller and you pick up the phone and start talking, then you'll get the voice that tells you to do da 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 da. So you were hearing all these things. Oh, you know, go down this corridor, spin around, do this, and then this happens. Some of them were actually real and some of them weren't. And so the first time ever, it was these, like, ghost stories in a sense going around the internet, because first of all, it wasn't always confirmed. Some versions did it, some versions didn't. So you have this great community of people scaring the hell out of themselves, going like, yeah, if you look through the hole and you wait for that stabbing sound and then do this. So it was a really, really fun throwback to that time when we were just that fun of video games and exploring the world.
Okay, so finishing up on the playable teaser for Silent Hill, well, I guess there's a linking idea. The Norman Reedus was cast, and that was a big fan to any Walking Dead fans, that he was going to be your character moving through these games. I guess he's already been in one Walking Dead game. That was the first-person shooter-style Walking Dead game, which it seemed less interesting than the Telltale series that Walking Dead has been putting out. And I think those are... It seems like the popularity for those is pretty wide, because they are also like tablet games and phone games because of how much they're story games.
So adventure games came back. Adventure games were really big in the early 90s, that, like, we were talking about, where we started with Maniac Mansion and that moved into other things like Data Tentacle, et cetera, which is a sequel. And they died. Adventure games totally died in around 96, with Grim Fandango being the last of them, and also a game called The Longest Journey. They came back past few years because we have cell phones, because we have tablets, and suddenly that lounging mentality of being able to almost read a book, in a sense, mm-hmm. that these games were. You could sit back, relax, and just play it. It wasn't a console experience. You didn't have to have the greatest computer to run it. You could just sit back on a train and start playing them. So you had these games starting to come back in, and Walking Dead was a perfect series to come back in because you had a great story with great characters, but with accessible action that anyone could pick up. You didn't have to be a gamer. You could just be anyone who knows how to tap to run away, basically.
Right. Anyone who likes the Walking Dead story could just show up and play.
Hello? Anybody?
You need to be quiet.
Who is this?
I'm Clementine. This is my house.
You've been all by yourself through this?
Yeah, I want my parents to come home now.
I think that might be a little while.
Staying put for too long is a mistake. Those things are all over the damn place.
Personally, I'd appreciate the company of a guy who can knock a couple of heads together if he has to.
I know who you are,
and I know you're a killer.
The world is ending out there. Who cares who I am?
Run!
You don't know who want to help.
You can't.
Think this through.
He's bitten. We gotta throw him out.
I'm gonna kill him, Cat.
You want to get violent, old fuck? Well, come on.
I don't know who you are or what you did, but you better become a better liar fast.
I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry I wasn't here.
Where the other game you talked about, like where it's like was like Walking Dead crossbow action hunting, whatever the hell it was, yeah. That's more of a first-person, third-person shooter made by a really bad... It was a product placement tie-in garbage thing. And,
that's too bad. The Telltale series, I wonder if it's embracing the limitation of, well, just the horsepower in terms of tablets, but it's such a stylized game. Is it necessarily pixel shading what they did? It is. Pete nodded his head. So because it was so story heavy, the graphics behind it didn't, you know, it was its own style of art. It didn't need to look ultra realistic because that wasn't the point.
They were bringing it to they were kind of giving you a cross between the graphic novel and real life.
That's an interesting idea.
It took the graphic novel and said, okay, we do, as you said, we've got to be compatible with console and tablet, blah, blah, blah. And so graphic novel maybe is the perfect example to do, and they just did a crossbreed between the two.
Cool. And the newest one I've been seeing ads is the Michonne story. So everything that she came across up to her introduction to the show, and I guess even the game itself incorporates Glenn. There's one or two characters that sort of cross paths with the narrative of the first two volumes. On our list is The Slender Man, which I had only known because the two girls lured a third girl out to the woods, and they sort of blamed it on The Slender Man. I guess it was a video game before it was a motive for murder, but I don't know.
It came about as a video game after it was already like a story.
It was an internet meme first. I think.
Yes, it was, and then the game was built on that, and then the murdering was because of the internet meme, not the game. They interviewed that girl again recently, and she said, yeah, I'll stab again if he tells me to. I mean, these kids are really invested in Slender Man.
Yeah, but I guess it's important to note that...
I've killed a few people with Slender Man.
He tells me to.
I mean, but it's not my fault.
What am I going to tell him? No.
He's so svelte. It's just kind of...
He's so tall and thin. He's like David Bowie walking around.
David Bowie told me to kill someone. I'd have to think about it.
Because I'd want him to think I was cool.
So from Walking Dead, why don't we cover its own subgenre of zombie horror? And even these sort of have sub genres. But so Resident Evil kind of fits under that banner. But
I mean, technically, it's a disease parasite. Zombie. I think crammed as many flash words into one thing, and then they're like, and they just tried to make the best of it. And I guess that is kind of one of the like critiques of the series. Is it gets a bit far fetched. Where it's like, wait, I thought there were zombies. Oh wait, no, they're not zombies. Now they're parasites.
And
they're not parasites. Actually, now it's a virus. Oh, it's not a virus. Actually, it's zombies. And it all kind of comes full circle. And you're like, well, so at what point in time are we gonna put like werewolves and vampires in here? And it just gets a bit convoluted.
Yeah, really.
This is Resident Evil.
Choose a lame. Resident
Evil. Resident Evil as a series.
Yeah.
So what happened real fast with Resident Evil is that it switched direction to action. They changed direction, and that's what you're starting to have. It's like, oh, we're distancing ourselves from horror, it's action game.
Yeah, I guess it was 5 that took place in like Africa or Haiti, I don't know, and that one's just a disaster in terms of like actual fear and suspense, and like all of a sudden it's just swarms.
I wouldn't describe it as a disaster, but I wouldn't say that it held, like 5 and 6 didn't, I played through them. I didn't play through them a shitload of times and find everything. I didn't rinse them.
In 4. Yeah.
Whereas in 4 was like, that was the sort of game that I would replay a bunch of times just because it was, the experience was that it took me in that much.
That's what the guy who created it left after 4. So then if you look at the direction, now it's a completely different direction.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, so let's... why don't we talk about the Dead Rising series?
Awesome.
From the start, do you think?
Meh.
It seemed like it improved as the series went along.
What I loved about about that series was the idea of an infinite enemy. Is that you? At no point in time would you ever be able to kill all of the zombies. So you
have to pick and choose in terms of your resources.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, well, Dead Rising started almost like an homage to Dawn of the Dead, where mm-hmm. you are trapped in a mall. And there's also dynamics in terms of, like, you have to take photographs because that was
There was some silliness and some of the character actors.
I forgot about the photographs. That is the worst part about it.
Yeah, well,
If I'm in a zombie-geddon, I'm probably not going to take some pictures.
The incorporation of mini sub-games is a questionable thing at times. So, I'm sure you could speak to this a little better than I can, but like the idea of having a bunch of Easter eggs and a bunch of things that are not necessarily pertinent to the main storyline, yet still facilitate into painting a bigger picture, they work sometimes, they don't work sometimes. And in the case of taking pictures of like a zombie that happens to have a hat, I don't know that that adds to the world.
No.
Some might even think it's a distraction.
And then there's also the options later on in the series, in 3, where you can go save people. Or was that in 3?
Sure. No, that's in all of them.
To me, I'm not going to save you. You're stuck on top of a car. That's too bad. I'm driving away. Like, I don't need to save you.
That's an option. And then you negate the resources that you would get from that. And that's a...
I'm willing to take that risk.
If you're on top of a car, odds are you're making poor decisions. I don't think I want you on my team.
Exactly. Thank you.
So it does seem the series got better when they left the mall, when they sort of opened it up again to like the sandbox dynamic.
I liked the mall one anyway.
I
liked the mall one anyway.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. I only played it very, very little. I kind of enjoyed that like anything was a weapon if, you know, put it to use. From there, we talked about the Left 4 Dead series in our zombie episode, and I talked about being a big fan. It's not especially, I guess I played it a little too much, where it's not being scary. The only real legit scares are when the zombies swarm and then it becomes like World War Z style. They're sort of climbing over one another, trying to get after you. But aside from that, like it's more about just, you know, exploding zombies. And there's certainly no fear of like your character becoming a zombie himself. All the characters, it eventually gets said out loud, but the survivors are immune. So that's why, you know, you can be bitten on and lose a little bit of life and not become a zombie yourself. But yeah, I think one of the stronger elements is that the developers put out the utilities for fans to make their own levels and their own skins, and they really opened it up. And that has presented, you know, the fans with an opportunity to like give the game new life. And there's a whole community for Left 4 Dead fans where they're making custom mods for levels, skins, you know, new designs on characters and pretty
boobs.
Cool stuff. What'd you say?
You could put boobs on them. That's always a good thing.
We got to have our priorities.
That's how I spend my afternoons. I just put boobs on everything in the entire game.
I'm pretty sure that's why people invented mods,
yeah,
right?
It was
just to put boobs on things. I mean... Who didn't want to have Sonya Blade fight naked?
Absolutely.
Wow, there's a Mortal Kombat throwback.
If I'm not killing for Slender Man, I'm usually putting boobs on things. It's my days.
Okay, so one that definitely caused ripples when the original teaser trailer came out, not in the Left 4 Dead series, but a new series, the Dead Island series. The trailer was the sort of intercut forward story with backward story, and it was all set to this like beautiful piano piece, and it was cinematic. And even the little bit of trailer that we got, it turns out it was better than the game itself when it was sort of when it was released. I don't know, the gameplay seemed a little stilted and less dramatic and less effective than the trailer itself. Do you guys remember the trailer coming out?
The trailer was brilliant. I unfortunately listened to my friends more than I should and just gave up on trying to play the game because they were so disappointed with the gameplay versus what the actual what they had anticipated
the
coming out of that the hype was way too much. And but you know, hey, tip of the hat for a brilliant trailer.
Speaking of one of those like public letdowns versus the initial thing, it bears some mention. The game DayZ originally was proposed to be this like massive multiplayer online game with, you know, tons and tons of levels that were broad, and it turns out when they released it to the public, it was a flop because it didn't come through with a promise. I don't know. You guys must know more about this than me.
Well, I think another thing that happened was you have these 12-year-old assholes who, like, rob you and take all your shit, and you're, like, old, and you can't move as fast as these kids, which are really, really good at the games. Like, kids are really good at games, and they will just take all your stuff if they don't murder you, and then you've just died, because that's another with real consequences. Now my flashlight's gone. What will I do in the dark?
The game has become just like a sort of scavenger game where you've got like raiding parties just fighting each other. The zombies, if there's any left, are incidental, and they're certainly not sneaking up on anybody, which I guess is almost representative of like zombie outbreak. If it happened in the middle of the country, in the heartland, where you can see them coming from a mile away.
I mean, would theoretically be X amount of people, and as a result of that, X amount of zombies. So,
yeah.
It's showing some promise again. It started off really bad. There was a lot of... It became a joke about how many glitches there were. These YouTube videos of all the funny things that happened, like people walking without their heads and all sorts of funny things that happened. But I think it's going to be officially released in 2016, at some point in 2016. And
right.
They're actually... It is getting better. It's still kind of in a beta stage. People are a little bit more happy with it now. It did win a couple of awards. It's doing fairly well now. And there's a promise of like being able to build your own base now. So whatever you've collected, you can put inside this base and store it. And so then that's safe. No one can take it. So when you do have asshole 12-year-old shooting you and taking your life flashlight, as long as you kept it in your little base, you're okay.
That's kind of nice.
So yeah, there is some momentum on it. That's something to kind of stay tuned with it.
That's what I'm excited to see it. It's supposed to be next year on the Xbox One, and we'll see. Because I'm still excited for it. I'm not like afraid. You know, I think it'll be good. I know that some little kid's gonna come and take my stuff, but it's okay. It happens all the time.
I do have a couple of friends who have been long term playing it, and to back you up, that there is kind of an idea that it was really good, and then it got really bad, and then it got really worse, and then it got just unplayable because you would just be walking along and all of a sudden somebody completely off screen one shots you in the head and you don't even know why you died.
Yeah.
And that's not a consequence. That's just bad game design. And the, but now apparently they've really worked out a lot of that stuff. So I'm excited to see how it pans out once the suits get a hold of it and make it a little bit more cash friendly, I guess.
Join us next week for the second part of our horror video games coverage. And in the meantime, find us on Twitter or visit our website, therantmacabre.com.